our response to the revelation of God. And we looked at how the liturgical calendar is coming to an end. The Christian year is coming to an end right now. A couple more weeks, and then the new year starts with the first Sunday of Advent. There you are. That's something we do in church. Nobody else does it, but we do it in church. The significance of that for us, among many other things, as you may recall, is that starting the first Sunday of Advent, we have 6 months through the liturgical calendar of how God revealed himself through Jesus and all the things that happened for that revelation. And then starting with Trinity Sunday, we have 6 months of how we respond to that revelation. In other words, what is God telling us, and then what does God want us to do? And that's enshrined, if you will, within our liturgical year. And we began last week looking at a few responses that we could make as we end that long period of the liturgical calendar of how we respond to the revelation of God. And last week, we looked at the church as the group that is called out of the world to be with God and to find God wherever God may be and so forth. The ecclesia, you know, where we get our word ecclesiastical, that means called out. And today what we're going to look at is the church that is drawn to worship, the people that are drawn to worship the Father and Jesus and the power of the Holy Spirit. And that's us. That's you and me. And one of the reasons that we have that prompting to do that and we say yes to that tap on the shoulder to be at worship is because we've begun to receive the revelation of God. God has revealed himself to us individually as well as together. And part of how we know that that's happened is that we have a response, a desire to worship. Now, we're created to worship, and everybody worships something just because we're worshipers. But you have received the revelation of God through Jesus by your desire. You know you have it by your desire to worship Jesus. You're directing your natural, created, God-giving ability and desire to worship on to Jesus. That's how you know there's a God. It's one of the ways you know that. It's how you know you've begun to see God and understand God, because you want to worship him. And that's what we're going to look at today. And the Greek word, for those of you who are taking notes on the Greek, is liturgia, where we get our English word liturgy. It's almost a direct borrowing out of that. And liturgy basically means the work of the people. Very basically, it means the work of the people. And that means, among other things, as almost everything we share, it means something, and then a whole lot of other things. When we come to the table, as we're going to do today, as we've already begun to do, there is a revelation that we are receiving. And that's the revelation of God's action in all of history, particularly with our people, starting with the Jews, and then going through the early church and up to today. There is something that we remember. We even rehearse it. And then, at the height of the Eucharistic prayer today, we will say together, we remember his death, we proclaim his resurrection, we await his coming in glory. At the same time, we're remembering the action, the powerful action of God in history. We're looking forward in hope to what he will do the day when there is no more crying or death or mourning or pain. And those two items, those two dynamics, our heritage and our history, come together this morning at this table, as they do every time we come to the table, every time we worship God. And the reason for that is the presence of Jesus is so permeating, so powerful, so all-encompassing, that it also includes our history, individually as well as the history of our people, and all that is yet to come. It includes everything, absolutely everything. And the presence of Jesus acting within us together right now and in you and me individually includes everything that has happened and everything that is yet to come. Now, how does that work? What goes on with that? About 10 days ago, Carol and I were at a luncheon for pensioned clergy. We no longer call them retired clergy in the Episcopal Church. Pensioned clergy. It's like someone came up and made a fist and pensioned you just like that. So we were at this luncheon for pensioned clergy. As you know, I've been on the pension for a few years and working part-time here and so forth. And so we went because there would be some excellent information from representatives of the pension fund. Those are the ones who pension us. And our bishop, Bishop Goff, was there sharing and giving greetings and doing bishop things and so forth. And she got up and said, you know, it's wonderful to be here. This is going to be great, a great seminar for all of us here. And I personally, she says, I want to thank you, those of you who are retired clergy, for being active right now, for stepping out, doing things that follow the Spirit of God and that are innovative, and all that you've done up till now and all that you're doing right now and all that you will be doing. Well, you step back and you think, well, yeah, that's great, and bishops should say that sort of thing, and that's why we showed up to hear things like that, and it's great, it's perfectly done. But I had a response that was much deeper than that within my own self. And I was sharing it with Carol as we were driving home that day. And I had realized this, that when I left the Diocese of Arizona, we needed to just stop one of the church plants that I was overseeing. I was overseeing two, as you may recall, at the same time. And one of them, we had to pull the plug. And so I needed to go find another job because there wasn't enough finances and all that. And our bishop was very thoughtful about that there, the Bishop of Arizona. And he didn't want to do it. He had wanted to go on longer and really wanted to see some new things happen. But he realized we weren't going to be able to do it. So he made it possible for me to go into the pension. I had enough years service for that so that I wouldn't be without income for, be no break in the income at all. And he just made it possible for me to look for another job. It was very encouraging. He gave a good reference. Pete called him. You could ask him. Oh, he did. Good. Excellent. All right. So I told you, he was a good man. Very good. Oh, he said that too. All right. Wow. Okay. Well, all right. So he made all that easy. However, in all that went on for me to make that transition, there was something missing. I was barely in touch with it, but there was something missing. And it was the acknowledgement that Bishop Goff gave about taking a risk, trying something out, following the Spirit of God, putting the sail up and throwing the rudder off the boat and see where you wind up. That sort of thing. And she thanked all of us for that. And something inside shifted for me. It was healed up. Something. Something changed. And one of the main reasons that was possible, that when somebody said something like that and the change happened, was because Jesus is present throughout our entire past and is present throughout our entire future. Because he is the Lord of all. He is the Lord of anything and everything you and I may have missed in our past. He is the Lord of every insult, every wound, every wonderful thing that's happened in the past. He is the Lord of every dream that you have and everything that you desire to see coming. He is the Lord of everything that has happened and everything that is going to happen. And when we gather at his table, and come together for worship, what happens is that the Spirit of God, the presence of Jesus, is powerfully, deeply, richly at work in ways that we can barely begin to describe, to transform us into the people He created us to be. And there is nothing in our past that can stop that. And nothing in the anticipation of the future that can hold that back. It may not go on the timeline that we desire. It may not happen in the way that we picture. But He is deeply at work saying these things to us, doing these things within us and among us. And in fact, our work, the work of the people, the liturgy, the work of the people, is not just to come and say our prayers and do the things that we're familiar with, as significant as that is. But that's just the beginning of our work. That's going through the front door. Our work is this: to receive and respond and release the work of God in us. The revelation that Jesus gives us now, the presence of Jesus right at this moment, in this place, among us, here, we receive, we let it transform us, and then we release it as He prompts us to do it. When we receive it, we see Him as the Lord of our past, overcoming anything that has ever held us back, any dream that has ever been squashed or put aside. He begins to reignite. And then He's the Lord of our future. And then everything we desire that we know has come from Him, we begin to see the path that that He makes for us to walk in. Now, one thing I've noticed is I can see a little further back in the past than I can into the future. It causes me to trust Him a little more as we walk into there. But that's what that's about. That's what a church that is worshiping experiences. Every time we gather together here in this place, that is what we experience. Every time you walk up the ramp and into the door and get ready for the liturgy to start, what happens is that the presence of Christ in a magnified, powerful way is there to meet you, to overcome the past and open the door to the future, to celebrate the great things of the past that you and I have done in our own lives and together, and to have it catapult us into the future that He has prepared for us to walk in. That is the worship of the church. Now, that's what we see with Hannah today, and from the reading from the Old Testament reading today that Richard shared with us from 1 Samuel. She just starts out saying, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in my God. There is no one holy like the Lord, no one besides you. There is no rock like our God." Now, you might recall her story. If not, I'm going to remind you briefly. Hannah was one of the wives of Elkanah. He had two wives. And someday, but not today, we'll try to understand what polygamy was about in the Old Testament. But some other time, we'll do that. There's these two wives, and as you can imagine, things did not go as well as perhaps they could have otherwise in a monogamous situation. But who's to say? So there's Elkanah, and there's Hannah, and Penaniah. And Penaniah had kids, and Hannah did not. And in that culture, to not have children was a deep, deep shame. You were looked upon with deep shame. And she didn't know how to get past that, really. So she was praying, asking God. You know, they would come up to the temple every year, make their pilgrimage as good Jewish people would do. And she'd be there praying, asking God. And once she was just praying so hard that the priest in the temple thought she was drunk. I guess she was Pentecostal or something. I don't know what was going on, but you know, just wow, look at this. What are you drinking this hour in the morning for? And she says, I'm not. I'm just pouring my heart out to God. I want a son. And so she goes home, and then it turns out she gets pregnant, and she has a son, and she names him Samuel. And she takes Samuel at the time of the dedication of these little guys, takes him to the temple to dedicate him to the Lord, to leave him at the temple so he could be raised to serve God all the days of his life. And the day that she did that, she prayed that prayer. My heart exults in the Lord, and my strength is exalted in my God. And there is no one holy like the Lord, no one besides you. There is no rock like our God, because this God had overcome her past, circumvented her physical capacity, overrode the shame that she had received. And she dedicated the entire future of her family to God, dedicating her son to that. And Samuel became the prophet who anointed the kings of Israel, Saul and David. Quite a prophet. Now that's the kind of thing, although the events of our life may not be quite so dramatic in their telling, they are still as important and as deep in our lives as they are with anyone else. And Jesus then meets us here to overcome our past and celebrate the great things he did and move us into the future. And it's not only Hannah that this happened with, it's also Jacob. You remember Jacob, whose name means deceiver? Remember Jacob was the twin of Esau, Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the last one. Esau made it out of the womb first. Here comes Jacob holding Esau's ankle, his heel. Symbol of being a deceiver. And he lived up to that for most of his life. Remember, he stole the birthright from Esau. His mother told him how to do it, how to trick his father, get the birthright, all of that, all these kinds of things. He wrestles with the angel and all this. And one of the names of God is this, the God of Jacob. It's the God of Jacob. The deceiver. And anyone who has trouble looking at the truth, wanting to face it, wanting to deal with it, even consider it, our God is that one's God. And the past of that person is overwhelmed by the presence of Jesus and brought into a new future that he has given them. It's the same with Peter. Do you remember Peter? Of course you do. One of the apostles. Some of you guys are studying Peter. And what happened with Peter, among other things, was that Peter denied Christ three times the night before he was crucified. Incredible. Followed him around for 3 years, saw all those miracles, all that teaching, all these things with Jesus, and after all that time, denies him in one night, three times. And each time, well, at the end of those three times, Jesus looks him in the eye, and Peter repents. He's cut to the heart. And Jesus says to him, Peter, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you. And when you are converted, go to your brothers. Anyone who has difficulty with loyalty would choose their preferences over the preference of the good of all, who would want it to be their way and no one else's way. Our God is their God. Our God overcomes the times. You just turned away, wanted to complain, didn't want it to go that way, wanted to tell, like Peter, the leader, told Jesus, no, Jesus, that's not the way it's going to be. Any of that. Our God is your God, who will overcome all those things of the past and lead you into that future. Now that's what it is to worship. That's how you know you've worshiped. That's how you know you're following God and worshiping Him. It's that the things of your past that have held you back, that aren't of God, He overcomes. You don't have to pay for them. He's paid for them. You don't have to overcome them on your own. He is overcoming them. He was present when all that happened. Our work is to come to the table, receive the grace, and walk in it into the future He's prepared. As Hannah did, as Jacob did, as Peter did, and as you and I will do today. Now, I've given you a few people from the scriptures where this has happened, and it's the result of worship, a little something from my own life as well. The question for you may be this: is there an incident in your life that's coming to mind right now? Is there a biblical personality that's coming to mind right now? There's a reason for that. And the main reason is that's what Jesus wants to overcome in your life. If that's the case, what I want to encourage you to do is take whatever that symbolizes, and when you come up for communion, you leave it at the table. And if it's a little too heavy to carry that far, leave it right now. Just drop it right now into the hands of Jesus. And then ask Him what He wants you to do. What step does He want you to take now? And that will be the work of the people, the liturgy that God's invited you to. Please stand. Lord Jesus, we bless You that You're Lord of all we've done, Lord of all that's happened, and Lord of it all that will be. And we ask You now for Your capacity to bring us to that place You have prepared for the glory of Your name. Amen.